I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up in our international briefing today, we'll talk about the status of gay rights in Africa. Homosexuality is illegal in most African countries, with one notable exception. Now, a new bill in Uganda proposes the death sentence for gays who are HIV positive and sexually active. We'll talk with a gay rights activist in Uganda to ask how the LGBT community is responding. But first, here at home, flu season is here, and it's hard not to be bombarded by news about the H1N1 virus, especially the push by health officials to vaccinate pregnant women and young children. But apparently, most Americans are not yet persuaded of the need. In fact, a new nationwide survey by the University of Michigan says only 40% of parents are planning to have their children get the H1N1 flu vaccine, far fewer than those who plan to get their children the seasonal flu vaccine. We wanted to know more, so we called Dr. Matthew Davis, who directed the poll. Dr. Davis is an associate professor of pediatrics, internal medicine, and public policy at the University of Michigan. Also joining us is Dr. Howard Markell. He's a professor of pediatrics and medical history at the University of Michigan and an advisor to the Centers for Disease Control. Welcome to you both, or welcome back in Dr. Markell's case, I should say.
Well, thank you for having us.
And good to be with you.
So, Dr. Davis, the findings. As we said, only 40% of the parents you surveyed plan to have their children get the H1N1 vaccine. That's compared to 54% who plan to get the seasonal flu vaccine. What reasons did the parents cite for not wanting to get the H1N1 flu vaccine?
Well, Michelle, we asked that question exactly to the parents and found out that about one half were worried about side effects of the H1N1 vaccine, and about another half were not worried about children getting the H1N1 flu itself. About 20% felt that H1N1 just simply is not a serious disease, and therefore they don't need to protect their kids with a vaccine.
And what about the side? Were you able to identify why they're worried about side effects?
Well, you know, the level of parental concern about side effects for vaccines has apparently been rising over the last few years, and I think parents are wisely asking their physicians and other healthcare providers about the safety record for vaccines. The interesting thing here in this case is that the H1N1 vaccine is manufactured with the very same processes and manufacturing platform that the seasonal flu vaccine has. And the seasonal flu vaccine for children has had a really great safety record over the last several years, for which it's been regularly recommended for young kids.
Well, maybe parents don't know that, though.
That's certainly possible. And the movement out there that is certainly galvanizing concern about vaccines is a very effective one and well-spoken one. Hmm. In contrast, the public health community seems to be having some challenges in trying to reach out to parents and convince them that these newer vaccines are safe.
I was going to ask Dr. Markell about that because you study the history of medicine. Dr. Markell, historically, are Americans distrustful of new vaccines, or is this a relatively new phenomenon?
Oh, no, it has a very long history. It goes back all the way to smallpox vaccines in the late 18th century. One of my favorite stories is about John Adams and a friend getting their smallpox inoculation and watching each other throw up as they got sick from the side effects. And so there were lots of ingrained perceptions of the dangers of these vaccines. And some vaccines in the past, frankly, were dangerous. But as Dr. Davis just pointed out, with the influenza vaccine, whether it's H1N1 or seasonal, we have an incredible track record with millions and millions of children and adults who have underwent this vaccine with no untoward effects and, in fact, with great benefit.
See, it's interesting you raise the John Adams story, because my favorite story is Abigail Adams, who made the decision to get her children vaccinated on her own because he was away. So she
Absolutely.
Had to figure it out on her own. So that's the part of the story that I like.
Yeah.
So just
and
as
it was
an
very
aside.
Dangerous. It was very dangerous back then, too. You were inoculating, literally putting in smallpox virus into people's arms. Very different process than what we use today.
So, Dr. Davis, your poll says, on a separate issue, your poll says that African Americans were the least likely to say they plan to vaccinate their children. But unlike a number of other areas, black parents and white parents weren't that far apart on this issue. 30% of black parents said they would definitely or probably get their kids vaccinated. 38% of white parents said the same. But Hispanic parents were the most likely to say they were going to get their children the H1N1 virus if they could. 52% of Hispanic parents said they probably or definitely would get their kids vaccinated. What do you make of that?
Yes, Michelle, this is one of the most remarkable findings from our study. usually what we've seen is that Hispanic parents have the same level of enthusiasm as non-Hispanic white parents. And for other vaccines, sometimes African-American parents are not as interested in getting their kids vaccinated. But here we have very similar levels for non-Hispanic white and black parents and much higher rates of interest among Hispanic parents. What we think is responsible for that is the fact that the H1N1 outbreak began and was very severe in Mexico. And because about two-thirds of Hispanics in the U.S. are of Mexican origin, they may have either contact with people who have had a personal experience with H1N1 or knew somebody who was severely affected by it, or they may have a greater sense of vulnerability to this particular illness.
More of a sense of awareness, a sort of a high awareness of it. That's interesting. It's interesting. So, Dr. Davis, though, in general, is ethnicity a big factor in determining whether kids get basic vaccinations, or does the divide tend to happen on things that are optional, like seasonal flu vaccine, which is not required, as I understand it?
Well, it's important to say that no vaccines are required by the government. Vaccines are recommended by the government. States, depending upon the vaccine, require vaccines for school and daycare entry. So the question, though, is about race and ethnicity and whether that's as important as other factors in terms of who gets vaccines among kids. And over the last several years, Michelle, what we've actually been seeing is that the gaps between kids of different racial and ethnic backgrounds have been narrowing. But what we've been seeing is a persistent effect of income on vaccination rates. And so kids living in poverty are less likely to be vaccinated than kids not living in poverty. And that, unfortunately, speaks to the persistent disparities in the U.S. related to income and health care access.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. And we're talking about a recent poll that suggests that most American parents are not convinced of the need to or are not planning to get their children vaccinated against the H1N1 virus. We're talking about this with Drs. Matthew Davis and Howard Markell. Well, just one more thing, Dr. Davis. This poll was taken in August, and I do wonder, I mean, the survey was taken in August, and I do wonder if now that flu season is actually here and that more parents will have experience with flu clinics, for example, that are now up and running, and so they can get some actual experience, real-world experience or feedback from their friends and neighbors about how these things are actually going, whether the results might be different if you were taking the poll today.
Oh, Michelle, I think that's a great point. And this is such a fast-moving picture and a difficult-to-manage picture that it's almost certain that what we would find today is different than what we heard from parents in August. But these are the latest data about what parental intentions are. And we wanted to bring these differences by race and ethnicity to your audience because we think it represents a different way that parents are thinking about the risks of flu out there.
And Dr. Markell, as again you study the so the history of these things as well as teaching pediatrics and so forth. How I don't know if you feel you have recommendations about how health officials should go about addressing the concerns that parents have. Certainly, a concern about cost. I noticed in the survey that some parents were worried that 23% of those who said they were not planning to get their children vaccinated were worried about the cost. I think that officials have been addressing that by offering free clinics. But how else should the government go about addressing these concerns? And how has this been handled in the past? What's worked and what hasn't worked?
Well, cost is important. And as Matt brings up, health disparities in this country keep a lot of people from getting all sorts of medical interventions or preventive measures. But I think the best way that the Public Health Administration can handle this is very similar to the way we doctors handle it one-on-one. Doctors are teachers and they have to teach people about various vaccines or medications or health interventions all the time. And the best way is to simply ask the patient or the parent, what are your concerns, and to address them honestly and openly. What has really changed over time, and I think much to organized medicine's credit, is that 50 or 100 years ago, we would dismiss such complaints or queries out of hand. We tend to listen to those very carefully now. And I think that's why things are moving so quickly, that those people who are afraid of vaccinations, whether it's flu or some other infectious disease, whether it's for themselves or for their children, is not a monolithic community. And there's many different reasons as there are groups or individuals who may have concerns about them. Some are divided by ethnicity or race. Some are divided by economic status. Some are divided just based on the intellectual information that they have available to them. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a better job of communicating. And, you know, the best way to avoid terrible influenza is to roll up your sleeve and get an injection.
And it makes me wonder, and forgive me if I'm asking you to speculate, but the White House issued a statement saying that the Obama girls were vaccinated with H1N1 virus at the same time it became available to all school children in the District of Columbia where they live and where they go to school. But there was no picture released, and I wonder if it might have been helpful if they had made a bigger deal out of it. Obviously, as parents, they have the right and responsibility to make these decisions for their children, and they've made a very determined decision, as most parents do in that situation, to not expose their children to a lot of press attention. But I do wonder in this case if you think it might be helpful. Very briefly, Dr. Markell.
I think it would. I think it was a great move. I think it was a very good thing to have the two Obama girls vaccinated. There may be a historical reason for no photographs. You may recall in 1976 when the swine flu vaccines were going around that time, which was not as successful a story, Gerald Ford rolled up his sleeve and had his injection in the Oval Office. And that was on the front page of newspapers all around the world. And so I wonder if some staffer may have recalled that and said, well, maybe we don't want to advertise this too much. But okay. I think it's a very good idea. I mean, people ask me too. I mean, Doc, are you going to get it?
And are you? Absolutely. Okay.
As soon as I'm ready. I already have my seasonal. I'm waiting for my H1N1. Absolutely.
Okay.
And so will my children.
All right. Dr. Howard Markell is a professor of pediatrics and medical history at the University of Michigan. He's an advisor to the Centers for Disease Control, and he joined us from WUOM in Michigan. Dr. Matthew Davis is an associate professor of pediatrics, internal medicine, and public policy at the University of Michigan. He's also the director of the C.S. Mott Children's Hospital National Poll on Children's Health. He was kind enough to join us by phone from San Diego, California. And if you want to read the poll we're talking about in its entirety, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org, click on Programs, and tell me more. Thank you, doctors, both for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up in our international briefing, a new bill is being proposed in Uganda that would impose the death penalty on gay men and women with HIV/AIDS if they have sex with another person. We'll learn more about the bill, and we'll talk about the status of gay rights across the continent in a few minutes. But first, a true story that reads like a Graham Greene novel. The setting is exotic, the characters mysterious, the details almost too bizarre to believe. It was called the Wanga Coup, Wanga being British slang for money. And the plan was for a small group of mercenaries to overthrow Teodoro Obiang, the president of the small but oil-rich Central African nation of Equatorial Guinea. But the plan quickly fell apart, and the mercenaries, led by Simon Mann, were detained during a layover in Zimbabwe en route to the coup. This was back in 2004. Eventually, Mann was extradited to Equatorial Guinea, tried, convicted, and sentenced to 34 years in prison. But earlier this week, in a surprise move, Mann was pardoned and released from prison. He returned home to Britain yesterday. We could not resist trying to find out more, so we've called upon Patrick Smith. He's the editor for the prestigious London-based newsletter, Africa Confidential. His publication has been covering the story since 2004. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Good to hear from you.
So, Patrick, what's the origin of the coup? Who wanted to overthrow this president and why?
Well, that is tracked back to a bunch of documents which have emerged, which really concern a group of mainly English public schoolboys, some of whom have served in the military, like Simon Mann, and some of whom served in intelligence agencies around the world. They got together, it seems, according to these documents, sometime in 2003 and decided to launch this plot.
But why?
What they wanted to do was to invade the country as a mercenary force, and that would be comprised of a few British soldiers and a lot of former South African Special Forces soldiers. They would then seize power And in the second follow-up mission, minutes afterwards, would come a gentleman called Severo Motto, who is Equatorial Guinea politician, who is currently in exile in Spain. And they would then install Motto as president of Equatorial Guinea. Following that, they would then form a government, and they hoped they would benefit hugely commercially. That was the plot.
Now, Simon Mann says there were many players involved in the coup attempt. He names prominent people, including Sir Mark Thatcher, son of the former British Prime Minister. He named former South African President Thabo Mbeki. He says the South African government, the government of Spain, the CIA, the Pentagon were all involved. Is there any credence to these allegations?
Well, as the conspiracy theories have mounted since the arrest of Simon Mann and the others in Zimbabwe over 6 years ago now, the accusations and allegations surrounding the plot have got wilder and wilder. But I think the least you can say, if Western governments weren't complicit in the coup, they certainly did nothing to stop it.
What was the motivation for the coup, though? Was it simply that they wanted to set themselves up as the leaders of this country? They wanted to live there?
There are documents that were produced at the trial of Simon Mann, and these documents refer to him as Captain F and said that he would receive $15 million within the first year of the change of government. Another 10 others involved in the plot would each receive $1 million each. Given that Equatorial Guinea is producing about $40 million of oil a day, those sort of amounts are entirely credible. I mean, the tragedy, of course, is that most of the oil money goes to the elite of the country, and most of the people in Equatorial Guinea don't see a penny of it.
I just want to play a short clip of what Mann told the BBC yesterday when he was released, and here it is.
Sure.
I am extremely grateful not only for my pardon, but also for the way in which I have been treated from the moment I arrived here in Equatorial Guinea in 2008. And it is a fact that I have been made to feel more of a guest than a prisoner.
Do you think that's credible, that he was treated more of a guest than a prisoner? And of course, it begs the question, why was he eventually released? He served something like 15 months of a 34-year sentence. Why was he released?
By all accounts, he was given extremely good treatment compared to the treatment meted out to most prisoners in Equatorial Guinea. And I've been there, I've interviewed them, and many of them are not fed, many of them are not treated for medical conditions, and either die in prison or come out in very poor shape. So he was certainly, to look at him, and I've seen the film clips of him, he didn't seem to have been too badly treated at all. Second point is he cooperated with the Equatorial Guinea government, and Mann was able to give them chapter and verse on how the plot was put together and point the fingers at those individuals. And that's helped them essentially to present the Equatorial Guinea government as you know, being the innocent victim of a horrendous coup attempt by a bunch of determined Western mercenaries.
Patrick Smith is an editor for Africa Confidential. He's been reporting on the attempted coup in Equatorial Guinea since 2004. He joined us from Paris, where he continues to report on this story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Now we turn to the subject of gay rights in Africa, and I should mention that there may be some explicit discussion of sexual behavior. What drew our attention was a rally in Uganda late last month that drew hundreds of protesters after the government announced it is drafting a new bill that will punish those who distribute literature or fund organizations associated with the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transsexual community. Having consensual sex with a same-sex partner is already a crime in the East African country, but the new bill also would impose the death sentence on gay people who have sex and are HIV positive or have relations with a partner who has a disability or is under the age of 18. Joining me to talk about all this is David Kato. He's Advocacy Investigation Officer at Sexual Minorities Uganda. That's a coalition of human rights organizations that support lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex, also known as LGBTI people in Uganda. And he joins us now from Kampala. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
David, before we look at the proposed bill, what does the current law say about homosexual activity? Are homosexual relationships specifically against the law in Uganda now?
The Ugandan constitution has what we call the sodomy laws. There is nothing like consenting. So long as it's a relationship between a man and a man, woman and woman, it's illegal.
But as a matter of law, homosexuality has been illegal for how long?
It has been illegal since the Bible came in. Because when the Bible came in, okay, I would say that the Bible brought in more homophobia than any other thing.
How did this new proposed bill come about? What sparked it in your view?
In my view, it's the religious right. These were from America. They came here and saying that if they leave homosexuals to be around, they are spoiling what they call the traditional marriage. So they came up saying that we, gay people, were recruiting children into homosexuality. So they started lobbying the parliament, lobbying all the societies. They put up a task force. So from that time, they pushed hate into everyone to be against anything to do with LGBTI community.
Why do you think this new measure is being introduced now?
You know, if I take you backwards, it's like this is a wastage of the taxpayers' money, because this law has always been there as canon knowledge. What they are just doing now is to make it more harsh on people. And you see that it's being unconstitutional. Anyone promoting homosexuality is being criminalized now. If a teacher knows the student is gay or lesbian, it doesn't report within 24 hours, the teacher also is going to be convicted.
So the new bill would not just enhance penalties for homosexual relationships, it would also create a push to report people for being gay or lesbian. How do you function, by the way, as an openly gay man, if you don't mind my asking? How do you manage it?
Despite of the hostile environment, we manage. What we do, we have civil societies, non-governmentals, that have the same aims and goals, liberating the marginalized groups. So we work hand in hand with the international, regional, and non-governmentals here to see that we can survive in this environment.
What is your biggest concern about this new law if it were to go into effect?
Oh, my worries. The first one is that within the 24 hours, they want maybe, if it passes, to surround all of us that are out and put us in prison. Then another issue is that the people we have been trying to liberate in the grassroots, in the villages, who even don't know that there's this bill going on. That's my worry of the people that I'm defending now that I'm a human rights defender.
You're worried that gay and lesbian people will be even more threatened than they are now. But what about also HIV/AIDS? Are you worried about the ability to openly educate people about HIV/AIDS if people are worried about talking about their sexuality?
We've been fighting to see that the Ugandan government plans to involve LGBTI people into their programs of HIV. We have been fighting to see that we're involved in it. So with HIV people, if they have been now trying to go out to expose themselves to get medical assistance, now they're going to go back into the closet and hide. So that means that HIV is going to spread more if people get back into the closet. They don't want to talk about it. We are going to go back into the dark, and the AIDS is going to spread the more.
David Cato holds the title of Advocacy Investigation Officer at Sexual Minorities Uganda. That's a coalition of human rights organizations supporting lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex people in Uganda. And he joined us from Kampala. Thank you again, David.
Welcome.
We wanted to know more about how homosexuality is viewed throughout the continent of Africa. And we learned that in most African countries, homosexuality is a crime. One notable exception is South Africa, where discrimination against gays and lesbians has been prohibited in the Constitution since 1996, and same-sex marriage has been legal since 2006. To find out more, we called Neville Hode. He's an associate professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of African Intimacies, Race, Homosexuality, and Globalization. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Can I just clarify one point? In most countries that you've studied, is being a homosexual a crime or engaging in same-sex activities a crime, or both?
Mostly the latter. And mostly those laws are sodomy laws from British common law. The Francophone colonies in Africa don't have that problem.
So is it then the case that the countries that tend to take the harshest stance against same-sex intimacy are those that were previously British colonies?
I mean, if one thinks of the places where the rhetoric has really been vitriolic, it would be Zimbabwe and now Uganda, which would both fit the profile you're sketching, yes.
And in those countries, as David Cato pointed out, you sometimes hear African leaders decry homosexuality as un-African. Why do they say that? Why do they think that?
I think a lot of the time it's the politics of distraction. I think it's important to remember that, you know, Uganda is a country that not only has a homosexuality problem, it has a civil war problem, it has development problems, it has a democracy problem. And I think a lot of the time these heated debates around homosexuality emerge as a cover for other kind of crises in post-colonial governance.
To that point, Kenya has announced that it will seek to conduct a census of its gay population for the first time, the explanation being that a count would lead to a more organized sexual safety network, whatever that means. So how do you interpret that? What do you think that's about?
The moment the state gets interested in your sexual practices, I think people are quite right to be wary. And I think that would apply almost anywhere. What's interesting to me about that is you sort of see the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and it is a real crisis, being used for ends that one couldn't really imagine.
What have been the circumstances for gays and lesbians in these countries, particularly countries with a heritage of British colonialism? Is it such that people have to hide their orientation? Are they under physical threat? Or is it more of don't ask, don't tell, as it were?
I would say it's more of don't ask, don't tell. I think also, you know, the idea that if you indulge in certain sexual activities, you become a certain kind of person is a relatively recent idea, even in, you know, the North Atlantic world. So I think we're seeing in these places the emergence of something which we could call lesbian and gay identity. And that's new. But I think people have been, you know, people do interesting things with their bodies wherever they are. And that isn't.
And what about the pre-colonial period? Do we know anything about the attitudes about same-sex intimacy before the colonial period?
Well, I mean, I think the important thing to remember about the, you know, Africa in the pre-colonial period is you're talking several hundred languages, a couple of thousand different ethnic groups, massively varying forms of social and sexual organization. So it would be very difficult to generalize across the board. The first chapter of my book looks at an event in, it's actually on the cusp of the colonial period, in what is now Uganda, in which the last indigenous ruler, the Kabaka Mwanga, executes 30 pages at his royal court because they are now refusing to have sex with him because they've converted to Christianity. Hmm. So, I mean, there is evidence of sexual activity. But I think, you know, the meanings of sexuality also shift in times and spaces.
So, as I mentioned earlier, South Africa not only does not discriminate against homosexuality, that same-sex marriage is legal. And do I have that right, that it is the
only country? I mean, South Africa is interesting because South Africa is the first country in the history of the world to have an anti-discrimination clause on the grounds of sexual orientation in its constitution.
And do you mind if I mention you're South African by birth?
I don't mind at all.
And so that begs the question, why so different than the rest of the continent on this issue? And indeed, it has to be said, we don't have that here.
I think South Africa is a very interesting case because it comes to independence or democracy very late. And sexual orientation rights agenda was prevalent in international progressive circles. And there was a sense that, you know, South Africa wanted to have the most progressive constitution that could be imagined in that moment. And then the other reason that I think, and this is an interesting one, is because of the experience of migrant labor, which was affected a lot of people over the course of the apartheid era. And, you know, most of the miners lived in these huge single-sex compounds on the mines. An institution of male-male mine marriage emerged. And the state sort of turned a blind eye to it. But I think those men who'd had boy wives, when they went back to the countryside at the end of their contract, had experience of certain kinds of contingent homosexuality, which I think is good for building tolerance.
Interesting. What should we keep our eye on if we want to follow this issue on the continent of Africa, the whole issue of gay rights? What should we be looking at?
Okay, I'm going to be slightly controversial here. I say you need to look at the international human rights websites and material with a fairly healthy degree of suspicion, because often they're invested in making asylum claims, so they're invested in making things look as bad as possible. And I actually think it's much more interesting to follow these debates in terms of cultural products, novels, films, poetry, to try and get to less mediated voices on these issues rather than listening to people who have a clear ideological agenda on either side.
Neville Hode is an associate professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of African Intimacies, Race, Homosexuality, and Globalization. And he joined us from member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, after years of funny white men dominating late-night television, a handful of new programs are featuring comics of color who hope to bring a different set of laughs to late night. We'll hear more about that in a moment. But first, we were just talking about the status of gay rights in Africa earlier in the program. We thought it would be timely to check in on that ongoing civil rights debate in this country, especially because the fight for same-sex marriage took a blow earlier this week. Voters in Maine overturned legislation that would have allowed individuals of the same sex to marry. Interestingly, voters on the other side of the country in Washington state narrowly approved a measure that extends some marriage-like benefits to same-sex couples, but not the right to marry. So we decided to call Lee Swislow, the executive director of the Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, for a conversation over where the battle over same-sex marriage is headed. She's with us now. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm happy to be here.
Are you very disappointed about Maine?
Oh, heartbroken. Completely heartbroken. I know so many couples in Maine who were really hoping that they could get married, you know, in their backyards, in their houses, in their churches. And it was very hard to have that taken away from them on Tuesday night.
How do you read Tuesday's election results? On the one hand, as we said, in Maine, it seemed like a pretty strong rejection of same-sex marriage by referendum. It's 53-47% was the vote in the exit polls. And it has to be said that every time the issue has come before voters, 31 times, it's failed. In the states that have approved same-sex marriage, it's generally because of court rulings or bills approved by the state legislator. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it says to us something that we know to be true, that many, many people have a deep discomfort with homosexuality. And I think for some people, that's explicit, and they're very clear about that. And I think for others, they've come a long way. You know, they've really worked to accept gay, lesbian people in their communities. And yet, fundamentally, there are places where it's still very hard for them. And I think in those states, Massachusetts certainly being one of them, in which courts or the legislature have said that equality means marriage equality for all, people have learned to accept same-sex couples getting married. Some have learned to embrace same-sex couples getting married. But I think what Maine shows us, as all those other votes, is that it's very hard for people to proactively affirm that they just haven't gotten to that place yet. So it's going to take us a little more time.
Well, what do you think the Washington state vote shows, where people are willing to extend substantially similar rights and benefits to gay and lesbian couples, as are the norm for traditionally married heterosexual couples, but they are not willing to call it marriage? So what do you think that means? And in fact, if you look at public opinion surveys, if you say, well, do you think that same gender loving individuals should be discriminated against? No. Do you think that, you know what I mean? So what do you think that means?
Well, I think it's a combination of, essentially, people, I think, want to be fair. They want people treated well. They want to do the right thing. And so, you know, civil unions or domestic partnerships, they've moved to that place. Clearly, there's something about marriage, though, that is very deep for people. I don't think, though, we would ever be at a place where the majority of people in this country, where, as we saw in Washington, the majority of the electorate voted in favor of these comprehensive benefits, we would never be here if there weren't places like Massachusetts, Vermont, Iowa, where same-sex couples were getting married. Because I think marriage in some places raises the bar for everyone throughout the country.
Where do you go from here, Lee, as a final question? Where do you go from here? There's been a debate, as I understand it, within the civil rights community about the appropriate strategy. Should it be, you know, activism? Should it be going state by state and approaching legislatures, or should it be grassroots activism? I mean, and there are some who think that part of the issue in Maine is that people did not appreciate all these, you know, outsiders, as it were, you know, the kind of the outside money, the outside expertise, you know, working on the campaign. They kind of interpreted that, reacted negatively to that. On the other hand, so what do you think strategically? What does this say? Where do you go from here?
Well, I think all kinds of activism is good. I think grassroots activism is good. I think state-by-state work is good. But what we know fundamentally and ultimately moves people is one-on-one conversations with gay and lesbian folks. And so it just says to us, in addition to whatever other kind of activism we're doing, if we really want to move people, we have to be out. We have to have hard conversations with our friends, our family members, our neighbors, because it's that long-term one-on-one work in which people really come to understand who we are and what our lives are about that ultimately will move people to embracing full equality.
Lee Swislow is the Executive Director of Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, or GLAAD. She joined us by phone from Boston. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Finally, to a very different topic, if you've been staying up late at night and looking for something on the tube to keep you company, until last month your choices were Letterman, Conan, Jimmy Fallon, Craig Ferguson. Notice any similarities there? Well, so did the actress and comedian Monique.
For the babies out there, Arniki, understand, baby. I understand when you open up them history books and you keep saying, wait a minute, where are we? And the only time you see us in the history book is in shackles and chains. Then when you see us only from February 1st to the 28th. Well, that just don't work well with my system. So we're going to start having Black History Month right now, today.
Monique launched her late-night show weeknights in early October on BET with a promise to bring a new perspective to late-night television, and she isn't the only one. Wanda Sykes is coming to Fox starting this Saturday with a weekly program. Sykes is not only an African-American woman, she's also a lesbian and mother of twins.
You know, people ask me why I'm doing late-night TV. Well, now whenever we ask our friends to come over, you know, they want to know, are the babies going to be there? I'm like, of course the baby's going to be there. They're like, oh, well, we can't make it. I got to go give blood. So clearly I had no choice but to find another place to hang out. So this is my home away from home.
And Latino entertainer George Lopez will be joining the fray, too.
Hey, this is George Lopez, and today's topic is one of my favorites. It's race.
Hey, George, my best friend Pedro married a white girl, and now he doesn't want to hang out with the boys. What happened?
Listen, if I scored myself a white woman, I wouldn't want to hang out with a dude with a goatee and a backward hat anyways. So the thing to do is go get yourself one, all right? They're all over the place, dude. They're on the malls, also Office Max and Staples.
Well, alrighty then. Joining me to talk about these new shows on late night on the late night scene are Damian Holbrook of TV Guide. He's writer of the Guide's weekly hot list, and Elon James White. He's a comedian, writer, and host of the web series This Week in Blackness. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Damian, of course, this isn't Monique, Wanda, George Lopez, one of the first people of color to have programs on late night television. Arsenio Hall had a program in the 80s. What happened to him?
Well, he kind of peaked. You know, he really burned bright when he first started, and that was a place for everybody to go. It was a destination show. But then there was a kind of a lack of sincerity, a disingenuous, you know, feeling to it, and people kind of tuned out. You know, it kind of played itself out.
And, of course, there have been other hosts of color, Whoopi Goldberg, Keenan Ivory Wayans, Magic Johnson, all had runs on late-night television. In fact, I had to look that up because I didn't remember all of that. But why do you think they didn't do particularly well?
You know, I'm surprised that the Whoopi Goldberg show didn't take off just because she's so good with the crowd. But some of the others, they just didn't have that energy. They don't have that chemistry. The Magic Johnson show was just so poorly produced. He didn't have that connection. He wasn't comfortable on camera. You know, it was a bad fit. He and Late Night were not good. And the Chris Rock show, I think he was just a little too edgy for Middle America to pull in the ratings.
Okay, Elon, what's your take on this?
I mean, all the shows, a lot of the shows that failed were because of like a lack of authenticity. Like when Arsenio Hall first came out, everyone really felt it was the show. It was a real show. Like, everyone's like, yeah, Arsenio, woo! But then, like as you said, it got played out. But those other shows actually started out kind of played out to begin with.
What does that mean? I mean, obviously, this is a matter of taste and once we think is funny is you know, we all have our own opinion. But what does that mean to you?
For example, the Chappelle show was very authentic. Like it from the beginning. Like he always made jokes that this show was about to go off the air at any moment. Because the fact is that he was doing what he thought was funny. Where he wasn't going in like we need to get the best ratings ever. It's like we're gonna do what we think is funny and then see what happens. Let's hopefully no one will sue us.
It was a high wire act, sort of. Do you
right.
think? Well, Damien, what do you think about that? And I'm also interested in your take on, you know, we are highlighting the identities of these three performers as people of color. Mm-hmm. But I think they obviously use that question. In Wanda's case, she also talks about her sexual orientation, which was something right. she only made public a couple of years ago. But they may see themselves primarily as comics. But I am interested in this whole question of how to what degree they bring their identities to the fore. And build a mass audience with that. And also, I just want to mention, of course, you know, Monique made a joke at the beginning. We played in the clip that we played about how the black people only see themselves in, you know, the history books and shackles and chains. Well, you know, I would edit that to say, duh, they're in the White House too. So, so it isn't cool. The only place you can see black people on TV these days, clearly. And you know, but
no, I think there's an African American kid on 90210.
Yeah.
But, you know, she's right. You know, like there's not a huge, you know, presence on television right now. But I don't think that any of the networks or the executives are looking at bringing these guys into late night as our chance for diversity. I really think in the way that you set this up, I think they've run out of funny old white guys, you know, and they have to go find new blood, whether they're Latino, African-American, woman, gay, lesbian, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're looking at their bottom line and who's going to bring in some ratings. And Monique, obviously, right now is smoking hot with Precious coming up. And Wanda Sykes continually delivers with her HBO specials. So you look at these two women and you think, well, they would be really safe bets. And Lopez, his show ran for a lot longer than it probably should have on ABC. So obviously he's got an audience that he can bring to this thing.
Okay. Elon, what do you think?
I first of all, I don't think they ever run out of old white men. There's always someone out there that they could put on a show. What's happening right now is that as it's been happening since, especially since Obama came to the forefront here, a lot of people are scrambling for blackness or diversity because like, oh, look, it looks like we're becoming more diverse. We need to make magic now. We need to put some more color out there. And that's why it's not like a big we want people to be happy and see themselves on television. Like you said, it is about ratings. They want to see if they can catch on to right now the feelings that everyone have about being all diverse and happy and joyous. And that's why they're throwing out the Moniques. But Monique is on BET. That's not exactly being very diverse there. But like with George Lopez, I believe he's on TBS. They're trying to catch that magic in a bottle, basically, which they tried with D.L. Hughley on CNN. They tried with David Alan Greer on Comedy Central. It's an attempt to get that market that's obviously not being served, like the hole that was left with the Chappelle show and things like that.
So Monique is on BET,
right.
Lopez is on TBS,
right.
And who is, as you mentioned, did have a network. A sitcom, and Wanda Sykes is weekly airs Saturdays on Fox. And so does that mean something? And she was heavily promoted during the World Series, by the way. So it isn't. It seems clear that the network is making an effort to promote that program. So,
oh, definitely. Especially, I mean, you think she's also got this role on The New Adventures of Old Christine. So they kind of want to remind people, like, this woman's on our network, too. And what the one thing about all three of these hosts also is they probably are the most likely to say things that will get people talking. None of these three ever really hold their tongues.
Go ahead, Elon. But, you know, can I ask you this, though? One of the there was this interesting conversation around the time of the inauguration about, in fact, one comedian, one of the late night hosts actually did a skit about that, is, can you make fun of Obama? Mm-hmm. And it, are you sort of crossing some line? And obviously Saturday Night Live got some attention when they have an actor, Fred Armisen, who is biracial but not part African-American,
right,
in essentially in blackface, portraying Obama. There was some kerfuffle around that. But can you – do you think the expectation is that these artists, because they are artists of color, will somehow be edgier around Obama or more take more chances in talking about Obama than they would if they were white? And I'd like to hear from both of you. Elon, what do you think?
I don't really think there. It's the edgy factor. I mean, I know people keep being freaked out about the idea of making fun of Obama. And the fact is that, like, you can make fun of Obama when Obama does dumb things. Like, there's no line of that you can't cross in making a joke about Obama. But I don't think they were brought on to be that, like, oh well, they're of color, so they can say things that the white people can't say. The big thing with Armisen on SNL was that he also does a horrendous Obama impression. Perhaps if it was funny, it would be like, oh, then, oh, that's fine. But it's like, at this point, he's not even trying; he's just talking, and it's like, why are you Obama? Like, it doesn't make sense at all.
And just to clarify, it was Jimmy Kimmel who I was thinking of, who did this skit at this black barbershop saying, sort of testing out his jokes. I don't know how you felt about it. I thought it was funny. But Damien, what do you think about that?
I know that Wanda Sykes has been very open about she plans on defending the president. I mean, she's ready to take on the conservatives, and her show's going to have more of that Bill Maher feel, where it's going to have a political edge, it's going to have the roundtable concept, but she's determined to kind of, you know, champion Obama. I think Lopez will probably have more fun poking at the president. And Monique, her show isn't really, it doesn't have that vibe. It doesn't have that political
vibe. It's more like a party.
It's more like a party. And yeah. Lopez's show, I mean, his set looks like a street fair. So there's going to be a lot more fun there, but his stuff has always been, he always goes into that immigration stuff and borders and things like that. And you can't avoid the political speech when you do
that. Well, that's interesting, because Lopez actually campaigned for Obama. So that'll be interesting. There are a number of performers in evidence at the Denver convention, but some actively campaigned. I know that Wanda Sykes, of course, has been a defender and supporter of the president. Okay, finally, Elon, we only have 30 seconds left. What do these hosts need to do to be successful?
Be funny. in the end, I mean, like, if you do what you do and you're funny at what you do, then hopefully it will hold water. Okay. And there's not much else they can do.
Okay, Damien, very briefly, you, what do they need to do to succeed?
I completely agree. They need to be funny. I don't care what their color is, what their race is, who they sleep with. They need to be funny and bring on some good guests.
All right. Damien Holbrook of TV Guide joined us from Philadelphia. Elon James White came to us from New York City. Gentlemen, I thank you both.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.